Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to this evening's event, which is hosted by the European Foreign Policy Unit in the International Relations Department here at the LSE. And tonight's roundtable event on Europe's security and defence policy is the first in our series of 10 roundtables, which the European Foreign Policy Unit is putting on throughout this academic session. Dedicated to European foreign policy after the Lisbon Treaty and sponsored by the European Union for Jean Monnet Programme. And we couldn't think of a better group of speakers, a better panel, to kick off this series of roundtables than our three speakers this evening. Most of you should be familiar with them and their work from your studies on the EU in the World Programme. Some of you your students perhaps will take a course next term on security and defence policy, so if you aren't familiar with their work, you will become familiar with their work, like it or not. This evening's panel is looking at, as I said, common security and defence policy post-Lisbon, and in order of appearance, we have Professor Jodo Howard, who is visiting professor at Yale University, but also Jean Monnet Professor University of Bath, and I suppose most well known out of all his works on security and defence policy is his book Security and Defence Policy in the EU, published in 2007. Professor Anna Menon, Professor of West European Politics at the University of Birmingham, also known for a lengthy list of publications on various aspects of European Union politics and foreign policy, most recently Europe. State of the Union published in 2008, and if I'm not mistaken, Anna, you're now on a multi-year ESRC program which is looking at European security policy. And last but not least, Nick Whitney, who is currently Senior Policy Fellow at the European Council of Foreign Relations, but has also served as the first Chief Executive of the European Defence Agency, and only last week, I think, it was last week, Nick, that the report appeared published by the European Council of Foreign Relations on how to stop the demilitarization of Europe, which is your latest contribution to the debate.
Hurry up, man.
So we welcome you here this evening. Our speakers have agreed to introduce some thoughts for about 10 minutes each. They will be then encouraged to perhaps exchange some ideas with each other before we throw it open to the audience for a discussion and question and answer. So good evening, welcome, and I introduce Professor Howard to kick us off.
Well, you know, this is a difficult time to be talking about this topic because many people are beginning to wonder whether the topic exists. I'm going to stand up because I can't see people as being outside of the focus. I've been writing about this for a very long time. I used to use the expression embryonic when talking about the European security and defence policy. Well, it was an embryo. It was coming into existence. It didn't yet been born. Then for about 10 years I was playing around with the metaphor of a baby in diapers, nappies for this country, kind of gradually learning to walk. But since Libya, I'm beginning to wonder whether we're not in the presence of a cocktail, sudden infant death, because more and more people are beginning to wonder whether this thing is viable or not, particularly in the current climate when we have the Europe. So I've really got four opening points. And I think that we have to accept that the European project, the European Union, is in something of an existential crisis. There's not only the Eurozone crisis, there is the first actual reversal of a policy area that Europe has experienced. And people have always said, you know, this ridiculous metaphor of the bicycle, if you stop the bicycle, you'll fall off. Well, I know lots of people who can ride bicycles and stop them without falling off, but you know, we are at the point where actually Schengen has been reversed, because we do have a kind of border control coming back in between Denmark and Germany. And that's the first time in the history of the minimally into the Brexit. I think there are four things then: political, institutional, financial, economic, and military. At the political level, I do think that we've reached a sort of Rubicon. Many of these policy areas were launched on a wish and a prayer. The euro was launched on a wish and a prayer. All the great economists said you can't have a common currency without a fiscal policy, without redistributive policies, etc. And the answer was, well, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Well, we're there now, we're at it. There isn't a bridge, there is a Rubicon. And I think we're in the same position to some extent as CSPT, that we embarked because we had to, because history's tectonic plates had moved, and the Americans weren't going to do it in the Balkans, they weren't going to do it anywhere, they weren't going to do it in Libya. Of course they did. Closely guarded secret. We'll come back to that. But we've got to this Rubicon again. Are the member states serious about wanting to do the defence thing at all? I think that's the question that we have to ask today, post-Libya. I think Libya is a paradigm shift. I think the fact that the Europeans had spent 20 years since the wars of Yugoslav succession, preparing for precisely the sort of operation that Libya represented. And yet the EU wasn't even in the running. There was no possibility at all that the European Union as such could have been invited to, or could have invited itself to do. This is something we can discuss, but I think there's a real problem there. Which is not to say that NATO is the answer. I think all of the current positive spin about NATO is misguided. I think that we're going to have to ask some very tough questions about what NATO is. Because it clearly is not an alliance. Alliances are supposed to work together. How do you have an alliance where the majority of the member states are opposed to the action? We need to take out a one-page advertisement in the New York Times saying, hey guys, we are no longer an alliance, we are something else, we are a mechanism for cobbling together coalitions of the willing if we can get troops and bring money together and if we really want to do the job. So there's a political question that Europeans have to ask themselves, and we really need to have big debate. Is this something that only the French and the British will do? Is the Franco-British Treaty the alternative to CSPT? What do Europeans understand by power? What sort of a world do they think they're living in? Nick will answer. Well, Nick will talk about this much more eloquently than that. So I think we've really got a major political question mark hanging over the project of CSPT, of Europe as a security defense. We have an institutional problem because Lisbon was supposed to give us the wherewithal to do this stuff better. It's a truism that of the 60 or so innovations in the Lisbon Treaty, 25 of them were all about common foreign security policy. We have these two new posts, which were supposed to confer unity and leadership on the project. We have the External Action Service. We have mechanisms like permanent structured cooperation. And yet the reality is that since Lisbon, CSDP has silently slipped right off the radar screen. It's slipped off the policy agenda. It is no longer there. There has not been one single new CSDP mission since Lisbon. The Somali training mission started before. And one has to come to the conclusion, well, before I come to the conclusion, let me just back up a bit. Javier Solana really believed in this. Javier Solana put all of his efforts into getting Europe together as a security actor. The current incumbent doesn't care about CSDP. Les Mauvais Langues suggest that she actually would quietly like to see it sort of, you know, played out. I make no judgment on what The reality is there, but what I do witness is that if we take Libya as a case study, because of the way the High Representative has interpreted her job, which is to contact every foreign minister in the 27 nation state before she opens her mouth, the Council, or the European Union, was, as such, was the last to call for sanctions against Gaddafi, because certain member states were opposed to it. Was the last to actually make contact with the National Transitional Council. Was the last to call for a no-fly zone. Not the first, I mean, this institution was supposed to create some measure of proactive initiative, energy, whatnot. And we have seen the institution functioning almost in exactly the opposite way. And that's a serious issue. There are those who say the job is impossible. And it may be. But if it's impossible, then it needs rethinking. And if it's not impossible, it needs doing differently. So we have an institutional problem arising out of the Lisbon Treaty, which we didn't actually have. Financial economics, you know, as Jean Brassens said in one of his songs, ce n'est pas le moment. This is not the moment to be talking about spending vast sums of money on defense, because we're picking around trying to, you know, get Greece out of garbage. But Bob Gates, the American Secretary of Defense, the outgoing Secretary of Defense, in his memorable speech in June, basically saying to the Europeans, the party is over, guys. America ain't going to do this anymore for you. If you want security and defense in Europe, you've got to do it yourself. Now, we've heard this again and again, ever since the creation of NATO. Burden sharing, stump up more money, etc. But this time it's serious. This time they mean it. They really mean it. The party is over. If we're serious in this part of the world about security and defense, we Europeans are going to have to do it. We're going to have to pay for it. So that goes back to my political discussion, the first point. Is this what we want to do? Do we want to pay? We might have a debate and decide we don't want to do it at all. Let's scrap all the defense budgets of all 27 member states and let's live in a soft power world. We need to have that debate. But the financial thing, I think, is really serious. We are wasting absurd amounts of money on 27 separate defense budgets, which amount to about 200 billion euros, $300 billion, which is more than the next six big spenders put together to take out the United States, you know, after the European Union, places like China and Russia and South Korea and Saudi Arabia and all of that. We put them all together. We're spending more than that for what? What are we achieving with this huge sum of money? It's being frittered away by a whole series of misguided forces. So finally, I come to the military dimension, which is the one that we also need to pay very serious attention to. What exactly do Europeans think these days about military power? What do they understand by it? Do they really want to do it? If they want to do it, how are they going to go about it? We're all talking about rationalization, pooling, sharing, specialization. These are wonderful words which we've been tossing around for about 10 years, and we've got hardly anywhere in terms of serious instrumentalization or operationalization of these very, very important military questions. What sort of a military player does the EU want to be? It doesn't want to be. I'm quite certain that it doesn't want to be anything like the United States. For a whole variety of reasons. One of which is that the United States is not doing it very well. But so we don't need to go down all those high techniques that the Pentagon has gone through. We need to have a serious debate about what sort of military instruments this European Union may need for the foreseeable future, the next few decades. And that is something which, for the I think we can make it. I don't want to end on a pessimistic note. I want to end on an optimistic note. I think we can cross that Rubicon, both on the Eurozone and on security and defence. And remember that money and finance and security and defence are at the very heart of sovereignty. These are the things that states cling to. But I think we can cross the Rubicon because I am convinced that the interests of the European member states are far more convergent than they are divergent. I think we are existing in an increasingly turbulent world where the stakes are enormously high. And if we are not a player, if the EU is not a player in that world, it will become irrelevant. I truly believe that it will become irrelevant. Washington already regards Europe as a non-issue, essentially. Not a problem, not violent, nobody's threatening it. We understand it anyway, because they don't. But the other players are serious players. So in that world, if we don't do something to be proactive and to understand strategically what it is we're trying to accomplish, as I put in a piece I published a couple of years ago, in the 21st century, Europeans could well find themselves in the guise of global migrants in search of low-paid jobs in the thriving economies of Asia and Latin America. My usual. This guy and I have never agreed on anything, so he's going to tear me to pieces.
Well, I should say, I mean, over the 10 years, my position on CSDP has remained exactly the same, and Jolly has just moved towards the growth.
All right, let's try to do the same thing from a slightly different angle. What's the point of having institutions like CSDP? Well, broadly, twofold. Security institutions are meant to do two things. They're meant to help states aggregate capability, so that together they can do more practically, physically, materially than they could do independently. And they're meant to legitimate defence action in two ways. Firstly, by acting multilaterally, states can intervene in places where acting alone they probably couldn't. So that's why states increasingly use the UN or NATO. Multilateral action tends to be more legitimate than unilateral action. But legitimation also in another way, and this was, you know, very present in the minds, particularly of British policymakers, when they thought about CSDP back in the 1990s. ESDP back then was meant to legitimise increased defence effort, the building up of capabilities on the part of EU member states. Okay, so there are two broad functions of institutions. The problem when it comes to looking at CSDP is it's done neither particularly well, if at all. I don't think the record's at all ambiguous. To date, CSDP has not fulfilled, come anywhere near to fulfilling the ambitions of its creators. In terms of aggregation, if we look at the world, certainly there have been missions, there have been some military missions. They've all been very small scale, they've all been relatively unambitious, and there isn't much in the way of evidence that there has been real value added in terms of capability aggregation by the member states. And let me just say in parentheses here, it's one of the great European myths that we might not be very good at deploying force, but we're great on the civilian side. The capability shortfalls on the civilian side in Europe are probably worse than those on the military side. It's remarkable to what extent Europeans get away with saying, yes, but we do the civilian stuff. There are as yet, I think, still under 200 police trainers in Afghanistan. And the target was only 250. We've had about 5 years to get to that high number. So don't think we're doing other things well whilst we're failing on the military side, because that's simply not true. And the legitimation side, I think, has been particularly instructive, because what has proved to be the case is attaching an EU badge to defence hasn't led to member states putting more effort in. Not, as Julian said, when I talk about effort, it's not because Europeans need to spend more, it's that Europeans need to work together better and avoid duplication. The sums involved are massive in European defence spending. It's just there's a lot of duplication, a lot of waste that could be, you know, if states thought about this, that could be got rid of. But there have been real limits to pooling and sharing of military capability. These are the new buzzwords. Let me give you one example of how pooling and sharing works. A couple of years ago, the Nordic states had a discussion that we don't really need several military academies for this part of the world, do we? No, they all do. We could just do with one, couldn't we? Yes, they all do. So who's going to close theirs? That's when the debate stopped. And this has been symptomatic. I mean, defence academies are fairly, in some ways, are sort of fairly peripheral. They're not sort of core areas of military deployment capabilities. It is very, very difficult to get states to agree. The failure of CSDP, or its inability to achieve the objectives set for it, however, I don't think has really got anything to do with the institutions in place in Brussels. NATO has never managed to get member states to live up to the pledges they make at NATO meetings. This is a chronic problem of international organisations when it comes to security. States make pledges, go away and don't keep them. So it would be unrealistic, I think, to expect a few cosmetic changes in the Lisbon Treaty to lead to any real progress. I happen to be one of those people who thinks that Catherine Ashton couldn't do much more than she could, whoever she were. I mean, she could be Batman, Superman, or David Miliband, and or a weird combination of all three. The dress of the the fact is, how can she lead foreign policy? Think about EU positions over Palestine in September, okay? When the French unilaterally sort of started to edge away from EU positions. Are you seriously saying, had Baroness Ashton staked out a position, President Sarkozy would have said, yes, you're absolutely right, ma'am, that's what we shall do. If you're dealing with nation states, it is very, very hard, particularly big, prickly nation states, of which there are a few in the European Union, it's very, very hard to stake out a position in advance. If we're looking for the reasons for the relative weakness of CSDP, Brussels is the wrong place to be looking. And I'll come back to this in a moment, because I think Brussels provides a handy alibi for member states in this work. The reason why CSDP hasn't progressed, I think, are the two main reasons, both located at the level of member states. Firstly, I just don't think many European states feel there's a need to worry about defence. European states, many of them, feel very safe. When Robert Kagan wrote that book about the weakness of Europe, about, American Little Mars, European Little Venus, many Europeans took it as a compliment. Not as the criticism it was intended as. It was like, hey, we've overcome power politics. We live in a nice, peaceful world, and we don't really do force anymore. Missing the point of the critique. The fact is, if you are fairly complacent about your security, if you don't really think there are any direct threats facing you at the moment, it is far easier to worry about defence as a tool of socioeconomic policy than it is to worry about the reality of, deficits in military capabilities. And let's give them no illusion here. People talk about high politics, they talk about sovereignty and defence, but more often than not, when states are reluctant to cooperate over security, they're reluctant because they don't want to lose capacity, they don't want to lose industrial capacity, and they don't want to lose jobs. Because rationalisation means someone closes something down. And even if there's an overwhelming rational military case for this, which there is, the Belgian Armed Forces, politically, it is very, very difficult. And in fact, it is all the more difficult in an era of austerity. So don't buy the argument that now that budgets are smaller, it'll be easier to cooperate. Now that unemployment is rising, it will be harder. And member states will be less willing than ever to close down capacity because it will have real socioeconomic impacts at home. Now, the second explanation at the member state level is what Stanley Hoffman, hundreds of years ago now, 1966, called the logic of diversity. Insofar as member states feel threatened, they feel threatened by different things. Go to Poland, they might not say it very much in public, but they're scared of Russia. Go to the Baltic states, exactly the same thing. Go to the Scandinavian states. The Swedes have Russia in their mind whenever they do anything to do with their defence capabilities. Go to Portugal, they've forgotten Russia exists. Okay. Now, the problem is, if you're dealing with states with such a diverse view of what security is about, whether it's about protecting your territory, Greek armed forces is a bunch of World War II tanks pointing at Turkey. Not a lot of use for CSDP, but the Greeks see a purpose in it. Maybe they just sold them on there. The fact is, member states don't agree insofar as they think there's a threat on what that threat is, which makes it very, very hard to come up with a coherent policy at the EU level. Now, it might be, I suppose, this might not be a problem. There are those out there, Gideon Ratman in the FT a couple of years ago, as I recall, who think being a big Switzerland is a great ambition for Europe. We should just settle down, be ignored, not worry too much about the problems in the world, and just get up, just go on with getting rich. just go on with stopping our relative economic decline. But this, of course, depends very, very much on your view of the world. And I'd recommend Nick's recent piece on this, because I think he puts a very cogent case that the world's a dangerous place. Are we happy enough to let others deal with what are real security issues in the world? I mean, that's a question, you know, we can talk about maybe in questions and answers. I think the world is a dangerous place, though. I don't think we've entered the postmodern paradise that some in Brussels talk about ceaselessly. Therefore, I think the lack of military capabilities is a problem. Let me say one thing on this, though. Europeans often talk as if their absence from the world scene is something that the world mourns. There are many people around the globe who think the weakness of EU foreign security policies is a good thing, because the only thing that ensues when Europe intervenes in the world is suffering and unpleasantness for everyone else. And as long as Europe's kept in its box, many people will think that's generally a good thing, given their record. One of the other things that slightly irritates me about the European Union suffers from what I call the Sky Sports syndrome. Sky Sports acts and talks as if football was invented in 1993. So if you ever watch football on Sky Sports, there are never any facts or figures about any football that occurred before 1993, which is annoying to me because my football team won the league in 1992. Never ever But the European Union acts as if Europe has no history. You know, we're a normative power. We try and do things for the good of everyone in the world. Well, many people in many parts of the world have a different recollection of Europe, so let's not uncritically accept the fact that if only Europe could do more, we'd all be better off for it. Now, just a couple of final points. We're asked to talk about the future, which I don't think anyone's very good at, but I cannot see much prospect of CSDP launching new missions in the foreseeable future. Firstly, because obviously attention is elsewhere. Secondly, because many member states are just loath to do so, if only for economic reasons. I mean, the Germans have made it perfectly clear that they increasingly see interventions in sub-Saharan Africa as a bit of a diversion, a waste of time, and as importantly, a waste of very scarce resources. The final point I want to make is this. It strikes me that CSDP has not just been dysfunctional, but it's also been pathological. That's to say, it's not just not achieved its objectives. It has in some ways actually made it easier for member states to fail to achieve their security objectives. Because it provides something for member states to hide behind. For many years, when member states were talking about defence, they'd say, yes, we're doing something about this, we're building institutions in Brussels. Very famously at the Laeken summit, a Belgian presidency official stood up and announced, ESDP is now operational. And a journalist said, what does that mean? He said, the committees are in place. It's a very EU sort of worldview. But for too often, member states have been able to say, yes, we're taking action, it's happening there. So if we're not doing anything, blame Catherine Ashton. Catherine Ashton can't do anything about the failure of member states to actually commit to substantive defence reforms. Too often, CSDP action is purely rhetorical. The Germans at one point wanted to participate in 8 of the European Union's battle groups. They never wanted to deploy their troops, so one wonders what they were doing this for. But it made them able to stand up and say, we're good Europeans contributing to European security because we are contributing to these battle groups. CSDP has been used by too many states to give the impression of activity and to distract attention away from the fundamental lack of necessary action at home, which is where it's needed. In this sense, on top of arguing that CSDP has failed, I would actually probably now argue that CSDP has made matters slightly worse than they otherwise could have been.
Right, well, this is revision. I shall now say rather slowly again, in different words, pretty much what you heard already from my two colleagues. If you believe in Europe's role in the world and believe in the theoretical virtues of European defence, it is a fairly depressing scene. I think the policy is, at the moment, dying on its feet. Heard from Julian about the lack of operations. I think I take a slightly different view on Libya, because that was always going to have to be run by a fairly sophisticated and swept up headquarters, which the EU simply doesn't have access to at the moment, or should have. But there have been new operations, the flow has turned off over the last 2 or 3 years, which is indeed slightly ironical when that coincides with the coming into force of the Lisbon Treaty provisions, which were meant to focus and make more active European efforts. I think I can kind of roughly between these two guys on where the blame lies. I think Ashton has been pretty hopeless at this. There has, in fact, in the External Action Service of the Union been a perceptible sort of takeover of, you can see it in the appointments that have been made, of the slightly, the very bureaucratic and commission view of the world, which is essentially about spending money, which is about how you use the financial instruments of the Union to conduct the foreign policy. And those who were earlier associated with this rather more activist Savala interpretation of CSDP have, on the whole, sort of taken themselves off to exile and other jobs and the Council Secretariat. And there is a pretty herbivorous mood around in the External Action Service. But that's the point we've also made, you know, at the end of the day, it's actually down to the member states. This is an area of intergovernmental policy, something that the role of the institution should be to take the horse to water, but whether the horse, 27 horses, choose to drink or not is down to them, and they obviously haven't. The thing that, I mean, again, there are reasons for this which have been explained. The thing that kind of annoys me about what's been going on in the last two or three years is that if ever there was a time to react to the economic circumstances, react to the inevitable fiscal need all across the continent, and to react to it by more pooling, sharing, and mutualizing capabilities, this is the time to do it. And instead of that, everybody has, as I pointed out, absolutely prioritized jobs in their arms, factories, keeping their own redundant wind tunnels open for jobs, building ships that nobody needs because it's marginal constituencies on the Clark, wherever it may be. And basically using the defence budget to serve all sorts of political purposes or economic purposes which have got to do with defence, which brings us to why, to this fundamental lack of seriousness about defence in Europe, at which point the Brit puts up his hand and says, well, hang on, you know, I mean, yes, there's continental, sure, but not us. Well, I wonder. I'd be interested in the feedback from the Brits amongst you. Just, you know, just how ready we really will be as a nation to keep on demonstrating our loyalty as the Americans' first lieutenant and propping up Afghanistan and Iraq. The French are pretty wedded to the armed forces, but I think probably in some ways more deeply psychologically attached to it because of the French deep preoccupation with La Gloire and its need. But I think it's a sort of essentially nostalgic kind of backward looking attachment to armed forces. For the rest of them, probably not. And the reason is that people feel safe. And this gallop polling that confirms this. Feel secure across Europe. You find people who are thoroughly insecure about all sorts of things, mainly about their jobs, about the immigrants who come and steal them, about their standards of living, and that sort of thing. But when it comes to the traditional threats that we normally talk about in terms of defence, they really don't see them. And I slightly take issue, I think, with Anna, even about how Russia is perceived in places like Poland or the Baltic states. And I think my impression is that on the whole, yes, the view is different. Central and Eastern Europe, fairly vivid recent memories of what it was like under a communist regime from, say, Portugal. But nonetheless, I think pretty clearly across Europe, people understand that the Russians are not coming. And I think that's right, for as far as you can foresee the future of defence terms, which is maybe a decade or so. But I think that is a sound judgment. Then the other thing that we're meant to do with our armed forces, for the last 10 or 15 years, we were told that there were new threats. There were far-flung threats out there. Failed states, regional politics. terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, proliferation. And the doctrine you will recall about is that defence was no longer a matter of manning the ramparts, it was a matter of getting out there and intervening in crisis management, forcibly and effectively draining the swamps where the terrorists flourished, which was embodied very very persuasively in the 2003 European Security Strategy, which in a sense is only written, CSDP has become now. And you know, in my time I have been a big fan of that document. I think the only flaw with this whole liberal interventionist business is that I think there's a great theory that on closer inspection it doesn't actually seem to work very well. And we have tested the theory of liberal interventionism to destruction in Afghanistan. We've given it our best shot, also recognizing it as 13th century nation, and turns out that our best shot was not adequate to the task. And we've done a whole load of other things under the banner of CSDP, which frankly have been of sort of fairly marginal utility. We have done some good things, and I think, you know, interventions from different kinds, from as far afield as Darfur or the Balkans or Chad, have had a degree of utility. Even the first intervention of Congo, I would say, was a modest success. There's not all doom and gloom, but slightly wandering off my point, which is to say that liberal interventionism doesn't look so hot anymore. And we can talk about, well, maybe Libya's changed that. I don't think Libya has changed a thing on that. That was a peculiar aberration, a one-off. Very bad happens, but it's not a template for doing more of those kind of operations. Which then brings you back to, so, you know, what is the point of having armed forces? Maybe those who talk in terms of the big Switzerland option have a point. Isn't that what we should be setting for? Shouldn't we be getting on with trying to make ourselves rich, or at least if we understand that we're in a global competition, I think we do need to wake up to that, just the extent to which power has slipped away from the West very badly in a relatively short period of time, a decade. Even last year, the new British security strategy was talking about the emerging powers. There's words in there about, you know, those Chinese showing promise. You've got to keep an eye on them. In a decade or two, there'll be powers to be reckoned with. And now we find that, particularly, it's most obviously economically, but also in terms of sheer reach and influence in the world, also that European influence is actually headlong retreat. All sorts of parts of the world which are important to us, if only because we need to have influence and presence there if we're going to earn our living in the future. Africa and the Middle East. Which leads me to the conclusion, and I think it's an intellectually honest conclusion, I'm about 90% certain that it's intellectually honest, and not just because I've spent an entire lifetime talking about defence, and I don't want to sort of, at this stage, confess that I'm totally mistaken, we don't need any of it. I think the problem is that we've become so used to the language of threats. And it's been going on. And throughout the Cold War, there were Soviet tank armies, that was the threat. What did you stack up against them? Lots of British tanks, you know. Actually, 600 British tanks, here's the bill, trade, prepared, you know. I can take that back into the world of dreadnoughts in the First World War, and go back to the 17th century and built your British fleet according to the size of the Spanish and Dutch fleet, which you were worried about. But I don't think that, well, certainly that calculus doesn't work anymore, because there aren't any plausible threats. And when you hear NATO talking about, oh, well, cyber threats, you really know you're scraping the barrel. Not quite scraping the barrel. Scraping the barrel is energy security. NATO's new mission in energy security, going out there guarding the pipeline. And I think the right discourse is actually not threats, it's power and influence. And I'm emboldened with that thought, because it turns out that everybody else in the world, except the Europeans, thinks that way. And this is why even those emerged new powers, be they Brazil or China or India, not even the remaining hyperpower, not what it was, but still hugely bigger than anybody else in the United States, all take their militaries extremely seriously and regard them as not just for going and doing their actual sort of specific function, killing people and breaking things, but as instruments of statecraft, as a way of getting your way in the world, on demonstrating seriousness, of winning people over by means of assistance as much as threats. And I think that is where we need to start thinking about the real role, what Europe would miss if it had no military presence and no military capability. Not how we would defend the borders of Europe, that might happen, but can we talk seriously to the Gulf states if all we can talk about is the language of exports and contracts? And these are guys who spend every day they need arms, thinking arms. They certainly need advice, discussion, reassurance, training. They probably need intelligence. You go up and down Africa, you look at pretty well every country of sub-Saharan Africa, and either it's a military drive running the place, or else it's a civilian administration, but again, on a daily basis, it's worried about what's happening in the country, the civil war, the insurrection, the possibility. This is a language which we happily don't have to talk in Europe, won't have to address things for horribly long, but it's the way the rest of the world thinks and talks, and it's the way in which, if you have an effective military, good armed forces, you can, I believe, engage much more effectively in terms of winning hearts and minds, power and influence, and then getting people to vote the right way with you on the UN Committee on Human Rights, whatever it is that you're trying to do, increasing the battleness and increasing the market of the world. So I hope that's the right statement. I hope that you'll be able to live up to that before it's too late. I'd like to see a European Defence Review to think about those kind of issues, trying to produce a more coherent view of Europe, what armed forces and armed forces are about in this, given where we are today. And I think it will probably happen as we move through the current economic crisis and come out a bit of core Europe, and I think core Europe will be a more politically integrated place and will, certainly core Europe will be a lot more interested in seeing what it can do with its military attributes to cement its position in the wider world.
I wonder if I could ask the members of the panel to add a couple of minutes perhaps on what each other has said, because even though you seem to reach a consensus between yourselves over what's right and what's wrong, there are a lot of nuances between what you have to say, and there's a shift in all your remarks between a sense of pessimism and optimism, and all three of you ended up on a slightly different note. All three of you actually stressed slightly different aspects of what's gone wrong and how it can be put right. Whether the balance is on institutional problems, whether it's to do with really an outlook on the world, or whether it's to do with a reaction to a changing world system. So I wonder, Jolene, would you just come back for a couple of minutes and pick up some of the points that you kind of make the
way? Okay, I'll just comment on two points which interconnect. Annan's insistence that it's all about the member states, and that the member states have legitimate and real differences in the way they see the world. The next point about Europe needing military power in order to influence the way the world goes. The member states exist, they are real, they have histories, they have their distinctivenesses, and so on. But on their own, they are nothing. And they know it. And even that is even true of Britain and France. And it's even more true of Germany. Germany is going in another direction. There's a debate in Berlin about whether Germany's best interests in fact do not now lie with the BRICS.
India, China, rather than with the pigs, Portugal, Ireland, Spain, Greece. And that's an interesting debate, but it takes the whole thing away from the notion of Europe. I believe that Europe, as I said, I think that the interests of the member states are much more convergent in this multipolar world that is already there. And this silly debate about are we going to see a continuation of polarity or are we going to see a multipolarity? Are we going to see a G2 between China and America? No, we are already in a definable multipolar world. And in that world, the only way in which European member states can have any clout is together as a bloc, as a European Union. And faced with that world, there's no way in which you can argue that their interests, their vital interests, are more divergent than convergent. I tend to agree with Nick that what Alan said about Poland was true 10 years, maybe even 5 years ago, but Poland in particular has learned that its future lies with Europe. Poland is actually pulling away from the American umbilical cord because it's learned the hard way that, you know, membership of NATO means you've got to send Polish troops to Afghanistan, do things that you don't really want to do. So that, I think, is the basic point, that Europe stands together or it becomes divided. But I'm not sure that I would go all the way with it in seeing, but I'm not sure, I've read the paper very carefully, and it's a terrific paper. But I'm not sure, the question is what sort of military power might Europe wish to be for? And there, I think it will not be the sort of military power we see in the United States. I don't think it will be the sort of military power that China appears to be putting together, and India. That, I think, is the debate we need to have as Europeans, because I agree that if we simply said we don't need any sort of military power, we can get by with soft power, we're kidding ourselves. But what do we do with that military power? Can we use it as discourse? So the deployment of a European aircraft carrier in the Gulf is a signal which doesn't need to be implemented. Very often the way American powers do. I'm not sure we can do that, so I'm left wondering quite what we need to do what and how we would do it if we made that decision. I think that's the fundamental question.
Okay, two things on that. I think there's always a tendency in studies of the European Union to kind of rely the should and the is. But if you say, well, it clearly makes no sense to do this individually, so we should do it together. And so surely eventually rationality will prevail and member states will do it together. It doesn't work like that. I mean, all the evidence at the moment suggests to me that many member states would prefer a sort of gradual decline in influence to difficult decisions about pooling and sharing capabilities, because it's politically easier to do things that way. So just because, you know, it makes sense to have fiscal union, or it makes sense to have, you know, common European air force or whatever else, doesn't mean that politically that's the right way to go. Those decisions will be taken. I must say, I still think member states are very stubborn entities, particularly stubborn in areas like defence. There is an interesting question as to why. Second thing I'll say is this, just if you look at things comparatively, let's just say that the two major projects of European integration have been the single market and monetary union. And why have those two come about? They've come about because the most powerful state or states in those areas have led by example, i.e. they've said, okay, I mean, and the euro is a clear example of this. The Germans have the strongest currency. They have the most to lose from integrating in that sense, okay, because they have the Deutsche Mark. But they said, listen, we'll take the lead. we will integrate our currency, which immediately gives reassurance to everyone else and everyone goes ahead. The problem with CSDP is the Brits and the French want everyone else to integrate but are the most reluctant to integrate themselves, and that is not the way to achieve integration. The strongest have to take the lead, because otherwise the weakest aren't reassuring. And that's a fundamental problem hamstringing progress in the defence sphere, it seems to me. As long as the French, and the British in particular, think that public policy is best served by sitting on the sidelines and hectoring, which is something they even marketing would have to think, they won't achieve what they want. Actually, what it requires is the big states to say, yes, we've got strong armed forces, but even we can't cope alone, and so we're going to put a marker down, and then we want the war to be involved. And that is the fundamental issue of society, and that's an issue that's taken very, very much to the national government.
Yes, the Britain and France is the two literally strongest members of the European Union coming together and saying, we're prepared to work more closely together, why don't all you guys join us? Sounds rather reminiscent of 1998 and the origins of the ESDP in Samoa. And that was then, and it's since wasn't enough then, and it's certainly not going to happen now. I mean, I'm afraid I totally despair of the British position on this. We're all very familiar with the UK's inability to play a constructive role in Europe, under, certainly under this current government, maybe in 5 years' time, one could speculate about a Labour landslide and a change of heart by a Labour administration, but even, not even Labour, frankly, during the Tony Blair years, was just enthusiastic about European integration in all sorts of different ways, as the sort of the rhetoric suggested. So I think we're kind of condemned to our offshore status. The French are less certain about it. I think that despite the fact that on one hand they are preoccupied with the bilateral relationship with London and defence at the moment, they're also probably capable and possibly even willing of playing two boards at the same time and trying to, if they found sufficiently active partners, to try and do something to breathe life back into a common European defence endeavour. But the issue is really at what point the is this business of having to push people who can see perfectly well the logic of what ought to happen but actually find it statistically or economically inconvenient now. How you can push people into the position of taking the decisions that on their best days they know they ought to take. And usually it requires some sort of crisis. You can look at examples rather small in its own way, but not big enough for those involved. Example was the crisis that occurred in the EADS, the largely Franco-German defence and civil aerospace company that was created at the end of the 90s, with Airbus as part of that, and it was 2-3 years ago, it fell into crisis over the super jumbo that was formed at high hand, and real crisis between France and Germany, and Sarkozy and Merkel sorted it out. It was a real governance problem. Up to that point, it had been run with duplicate systems. There were twin chief executives and twin chairmen of Germany, and that system simply wasn't working anymore. And having decided that it did need to be sorted out, Sarkozy and Merkel, despite all the well-known stuff about their different personalities, etc., etc., sorted it out. And it took them 3 or 4 meetings and a lot of effort and a lot of pain to come up with a truly integrated management structure for the EADS. So if they chose to do the same on European defence, then I believe that something could be done. They actually could start striking deals about the French would simply have to give up their businesses in armour fighting vehicles, and the Germans would have to give up their aspirations in something else, and they've integrated their repair and overhaul systems and be able to attract other people in to those sort of things if they took it sufficiently seriously. And maybe when we've got through the quite surprising things that are going to happen in my expectation in terms of the structure of the politics and the governance of Europe as a result of the euro crisis, maybe once the leaders have done that, they'll feel the appetite to move on and do something about other lesser policies like the defence policy.
Okay, thank you very much. Perhaps we can now open it up to discussion and questions. We have plenty of time to take your questions. If you are going to ask a question, please identify yourself for our speaker's benefit. Who's going to go first?
Status from war, no profit from war, and no So we read the other day that the Obama administration rejected a cyber attack on India, not to create a new precedent where Russia and China might follow, because it could have won the war in 2 days. But probably the European Union, which doesn't have the potential of making a cyber attack, had it had that potential, would not have done so on the grounds of health and safety. Simply, it couldn't imagine doing such a thing to the poor Indian people. The third point I want to make is that perhaps you can overlook unfair to the Europeans, because I also see problems with the United States in the future. I think it's a problem with democracy. It's not when McKinley, our former director of the Institute, said that democracy is part of the Institute, except if war or published by the top of the world. And if you look at someone like Frank Leverage's latest book on declining British military power, and the terrible record of the Shah in Iraq and Afghanistan in the last 10 years, he doesn't say it's the equivalent of the Thomas's Institute, but the lack of strategic thinking by our generals and the inability of politics to even understand what strategy is. So if you look at the Quadrennial Defence Review in the 1960s, that's an equally depressing document. I mean, it's almost as depressing as the European security strategy, where it talks about China and Russia as centres of excellence rather than powers to be dealt with in a nice sort of way, of course, but you've no idea how it could actually turn out despite the revolution. So I would say that I think what we've seen in the last 10 years, both in the United States and in the EU, is a failure to make strategic which may either be a prophecy or maybe a short term of the post-population we thought we were living in, and now suddenly rising China has forced us to take stock. And actually, after all, we've been having to see what's the nature. One question that we're going to be asking
well, just in reverse order, I think you're right about the strategic thing. But Thomas Friedman wrote a piece a few weeks ago in I'd Like to Be China for a Day, which basically making this very same point, which is give me a day without democratic constraints and I'll solve all the problems and we can go back to being democratic again. So I think that's absolutely true, and I think actually the European Union has that problem in spades. It's decision making doesn't exist for strategic thinking within Europe because everybody's got to coordinate. So I think you're absolutely right on that. I think it's a structural problem, and whether it's down to electoral calendars or something additional to that, I don't know. But you're absolutely right. On lawfare, yes, to a point. Though I think the danger is, and again, I'm no great fan of Kagan. He just keeps coming into my head today. I mean, I think there's a useful phrase that, if you've got a hammer, everything seems nail-shaped. And that's the thing about the European Union. If you haven't got the tools of hard power, everything seems resolvable through multilateral negotiations. And it's very, very striking. China is a matter of multilateral negotiations and technical committees around the table. If you're the United States, China's a real worry with the string of pearls in the South China Sea. Maybe the truth lies somewhere in between, but I think the European Union boxes itself in. There is merit to the sort of law side and the multilateralism side, but if you blinker yourself to the extent that everything is seen in that way, I suspect that eventually we'll get something very, very bad in the way. We misinterpret an international problem to our cost. And the final point on the technocratic elite. Remember, in the mid-1990s, the Americans had a program to undertake a process of base closures after the Cold War. And their politicians couldn't do it. And what they did was they set up a commission, I think. And they set up this commission with very specific powers. The purpose of this commission was to draw up a list of bases that should be closed because they didn't need them anymore. And the list was to be decided on by Congress by straight up or down votes. That's to say, you couldn't pick it apart, you couldn't say, well, actually, Kentucky needs that base because I'm up for re-election. You either said yes to the whole list or no. So they delegated to the technocrats as a way of making efficient decisions. And in a sense, that's very much the rationale behind the European Defence Agency. Which is, if you're going to delegate, you have to do it properly. You can't delegate, then control it, because it's worthless. So, yes, you're right, there's a different culture when it comes to warfare in the United States with many European countries, and particularly the European Union. But that doesn't mean that you can't do defence in a technocratic way on some occasions. I think themselves.
I said there's a lot of Europe. A lot of these things are matters of habit. In a sense, the whole
developing their relationships so that they no longer were vassals of foreign relations, the family vassals within a community and then within a union. So in those circumstances, I suppose it's unsurprising that what you do have is the emergence of technocratic elites who are interested in massive economics, massive structural and social policies and regional policies and so on, and are not focused on foreign security policy or defence issues, and why a lot of that has been a rather late accretion to a Europe gradually waking up at the turn of the century that it is necessary to play some sort of a role in the wider world. I think the point is simply that we're just rather late and rather complacent about, we've kind of missed the way in which events have spun out of Europe and the West's control over the last decade. If you go back to about the year 2000, there was this sort of strong millennial sense that there's a book written by someone I work closely with called Why Europe Will Run the 21st Century. He says the publishers. There's a subtle reading of the text will show that wasn't what he was saying at all. But there was a zeitgeist in saying that, you know, we had found a new way of conducting business in Europe at that time. We were herbivorous and we were to do with the rules-based world and the multilateral world, and that in a sense our soft power was our strength. Nobody threatened by us. Poland was done to say, you know, if your country, no Indians, did not rise to the top of the global pecking order, who would you like to see at the top? You know, Europe was always the favourite, because we were unthreatened and we were nice. And yeah, this was very honourable, this was very, we would attract people, they would want to be like us. ASEAN would turn into the European Union, the Southeast Asia and all this. It's a bit like those 19th century murals of Britannia teaching her sons the arts of war and peace.
I mean, fine if we could have done it, but we've just
globalization worked as advertised. Everybody else suddenly got a whole lot richer and a whole lot more powerful with it, and they're having to rather belatedly work out what the consequences are. And as for the warfare thing, I mean, I think it's a European strength that we have been, although I try to advocate a position of taking hard power seriously, I don't think it's wrong. I think once or twice or three times before dropping bombs on people, and one of the fantastic successes of the Libyan campaign does seem to have been how accurate and restrained the bombing campaign has been. Not only the new casualties have suffered from our side, but not even the extraordinary Gaddafi spokesman was able to find a plausible example of a million civilian damage by a NATO attack, and that's all good stuff.
The lack of strategy is a fundamental problem, and we, a number of us, me myself, have written so much on this, we've bored ourselves to death with it. Without a strategy, we're just sort of turning around on a turntable. But I think that the issue of whether democracies are fighting with their hands tied behind their backs, we've heard this sort of repeatedly ever since the Russian Revolution. The Trilateral Commission produced a wonderful study in 1992 about what the date might call the governability of democracies. And the conclusion was that democracies are bound to lose out against communism because they do things in a long-winded and roundabout and legalistic fashion. And that therefore you can't win on that. I don't really believe that. I didn't believe that at the time. It emerged out of the Vietnam War, really, that you can't beat them because you've got your public on the street sort of making life difficult for you, and therefore we're going to lose. I don't think that's the case. I think the public are in the streets in Beijing, the public in the streets all over the world at the moment, and they are
of the United States, so that the people in Congress are never going to vote the veto power away because they're, you know, they're just vote. It's structurally sort of entwined with the whole thing. The absurdity of it seems to me, and this comes back to the question of what we do with the impeachment, is that, and this is something I don't think anybody said today, which needs saying, that war is on its way out. You know, there's a wonderful book just being published by Joshua Goldstein, but there are others. John Muller has written about that. You have a line going back as far in history as you can go. War-related deaths are just constantly going down, constantly. Two big lip-ups in 1914-18, 1939-45, which prove the point that war does not pay. We have won the war on war, and the only wars really that are taking place now are civil wars, insurgencies, and so on. And really, the American strategists are beginning to ask themselves the question of what capacity they need to do the sorts of operations that they are doing so badly in Afghanistan. Sam McChrystal, who has been massacred in the media for all sorts of reasons, I think has genuinely had to rethink almost all of American military doctrine and ask the question, what is there left to be done with the treatment and how do we do it? It's very difficult. So, final point on you know our relation with the emerging powers. I said I don't think that democracy is at a disadvantage against authoritarianism. But my point in arguing for a Europe which has a strategic sense of what it is trying to achieve in the world is predicated on the assumption that we are going to have to bargain with these people. There's a wonderful new book by John Eikenberry from Princeton, which you may know about, called The Liberal Leviathan. Eikenberry argues that the West is so good, so strong, so perfect, such a model, that the rest of the world will simply sign on to Western norms. I don't think that's true at all. And we are going to have to get into serious bargaining mode with the Indians, the Chinese, the South Africans, the Turks, we're already bargaining with them. And we're going to have to make compromises. And we need to be very clear what our bottom line is in those negotiations. Robert Hutchins has called this a global grand bargain, and I think that's where we've got to go for a global grand bargain. We're not going to be fighting. I don't believe we're going to be fighting these people. I was astonished, I was at Chatham House last week. And a very eminent British foreign ambassador said a war between America and China is inevitable. What? I think it is a problem. And I don't think that either side really is
solved, of course. This is not in the newspaper, but I think it is going to be German.
German. So the leverage of Germany would be much more important than it is now. And really, Britain is not going to be. So, I would like to know which is your position, your idea on the importance of the German position as most people in the head of the Portugal in the present of the common life.
Are there any more questions?
Follow along behind to preserve that triangle.
One last point to pick up from me, which is this hard power, soft power distinction, difficult tasks done by NATO, easy tasks done by the European Union. I think that falls down on two grounds. A, the point that Anne made right at the beginning of the proceedings, that this famous European capacity to undertake softer tasks like sending policemen into troubled areas and so on actually just doesn't exist. It's great to talk about, but we have no more capable of that area than our military. And then, secondly, NATO doing hard power. Well, yeah, but what's NATO going to do next? Is the US executes its pivot towards the Pacific, and one hears ever more clearly from Americans that Europeans should, if they want a healthy future NATO, they have to choose between either making themselves useful to Americans in the Pacific, or if you don't fancy that, then learn to think for yourselves, because we Americans will be preoccupied elsewhere. I think I'll stop there.
Well, that's actually a good place for that to come to. Follow on with what you said there. On the NATO thing, I see two futures in NATO, two potential futures in NATO. Apart from what everybody's predicting, which is that NATO will die. The death of NATO ain't going to happen. The too many people with jobs in NATO. But two futures are the one. One of them is the one I outlined earlier, which is that NATO will become a mechanism for cobbling together coalitions of the world. To follow American ground strategy wherever it goes in the world. This is what the Americans have been leading with the Europeans to do ever since the end of the Cold War, and indeed before the end of the Cold War. NATO should go global. Well, it's gone global. It's gone to Afghanistan. It's made a terrible mess of it. In a sense, Libya is the kind of saving grace in some ways, but let's not be fooled that America led from behind without the American input. So that's one possible scenario, that this NATO will pick up, you know, Australia, New Zealand, and South Korea, South Africa, and one or two other countries, and become a global cobbling together exercise under American leadership, which is pretty much what it has become. But that then leaves the Europeans asking, well, what are we going to do about Europe? What are we going to do for ourselves? And we have to answer that question if that is the future for NATO. Now, the other answer to the question, the second possible future for NATO, is the one that's being actively touted in Paris, France, that NATO will become CSDP, or CSDP will become NATO. In other words, Europeans will take over NATO, as they did in NATO, and use it in the theatre that it was devised for, which is the North Atlantic area, or essentially in Europe. So we'll have the NATO CSDP conundrum will be solved by a merger in which France and Britain will essentially take over. Now, that notion doesn't get the time of day in London, but it is very seriously important in Paris. One quick word on how we're doing on the other type of security. Reasonably well on terrorism, despite the fact that terrorism for Britain is Pakistan, for France is Algeria, for Spain is Morocco, for Germany is Turkey, and that these are not necessarily connected in any way, but there is a sort of reasonable coordination of that. We're not doing very well, really, on if you take the immigration issue as a security issue, which public opinion tends to. We saw horrible swapping over what we were going to do with the voting. But let me just finish by saying that really security for the vast majority of people in Europe means jobs. That's security. Fundamental security. And if Germany is in charge, I'm not sure that a cure of austerity right across the board for everybody, one size fits all, isn't going to be much of a job.
I don't share the optimism, if you want to call it that, that the EU will integrate more in response to the euro crisis. I think even when it comes to matters financial, the Eurozone will impose its own token tax on Euro members. What nonsense, the argument is. Because, you know, it's the same old problem. You don't want to go ahead with potentially costly measures which other people escape because, you know, people, you know, businesses in Ireland will flee to Britain. Businesses in Frankfurt. I don't think it's as straightforward as that. I suspect that if Merkel is serious about shooting, it might not go that far. Because there are just too many divergent interests within the Eurozone, let alone at 27, which is, of course, how the negotiation has to be. Now, in defence, again, it's different logics at work. But in defence, it's very hard to keep people out, and people don't like to be excluded. And because the European Defence Agency has never been given the authority to carry out the role that Lisbon gives it, I don't see any great prospect for that. States will continue to cooperate bilaterally, multilaterally, whatever it may be. I mean, you know, some member states have got a long, long way down the line. The Dutch and Belgium don't have a fleet each. They've actually had a fleet. Because they've proven shared to such an extent, not least in the European Union, which has gone ahead and done that. And that will continue to happen. I don't see the emergence of an organised bloc in defence, like the emergence of, say, Schengen or something like that, because I think interest will shift. And depending on where the European Union is intervening, different states will be interested in participating. Like that. We'll never move from a situation where all member states have to approve admission. And that's the critical thing. For all sorts of reasons, all member states will cling to their right to form the approval of admission. But a subset of states will take part in those missions. And that, again, make it clear as traditionalist I am, absolutely NATO will be high end in the EU and the low end. There is nothing I have seen in recent years that makes me think if there's a conflict, wherever it may be, it's in the European border, wherever the Americans themselves are going to be. Public opinion purposes at home try and hide, like they did in Libya, well, running the mission. And I suspect the problem bill for Libya or the other bill for Libya is not bigger than the British or French bill for Libya. The Americans will always want to be in the US for that. Because their interest will be at stake, because they're a global power. And so, whenever there's something of a reasonable size, the Americans want to be involved, it will be done through NATO. If there's something very small, the former Foreign Office official, when CSDP was first created, used to say there's three sorts of missions. There's a NATO mission, there's a Berlin Cross mission, which the EU does with using NATO procedures and NATO support, and there's an European Union mission. And essentially, EU missions are about getting cats from trees. Now, they might be particularly tall trees, but ultimately, EU autonomous missions will continue to be very self-contained, very small scale. Anything larger with the EU elsewhere, in the first place, they will look better.
Thank you all very much indeed. We've come to the end of our time. Before thanking our panellists for setting such a good example for the rest of the series, I'm obliged to announce the next instalment of this roundtable series, which is to take place on the 6th of December, 6:30, in room 602, and the topic of that day's roundtable is the role of parliaments in European foreign policy making, a panel comprised of parliamentarians both from the UK and from the European Parliament. So I hope to see a lot of you there, but for the time being, on your behalf, I'd like to thank Anna and Jolyon and Nick for setting such a precedent for the rest of the series and providing such a stimulating space to see. Thank you very much.